You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Dan Baum went to New Orleans to cover the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, he decided that the real story wasn't the storm, but the individuals whose lives had been affected by it. In his new book, Nine Lives, Death and Life in New Orleans, Mr. Baum has woven together narratives from nine very different Big Easy residents in order to understand what keeps them living in a city that was afflicted by crime, poverty, and violence for many years before Katrina. It's published by Random House, and it brings Dan Baum back to the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
A review in Publishers Weekly notes, Baum's Chronicle leaves readers with a bittersweet understanding of what Americans lost during Hurricane Katrina. Americans lost it?
Oh, yeah. This city is a treasure in that it is, in a way, the opposite of New York. Up here in New York, we are driven by the dollar and the clock, and really everywhere in the United States.
Speak for yourself,
Dan. We are driven by the dollar and the clock, and we're working the BlackBerry with one hand and holding the coffee cup with another, and go, 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 and we're thinking about the future, and we're thinking about getting ahead, and we're thinking about making the dollar, and we're thinking about our next appointment. And life in New Orleans just is the polar opposite. You know, I like to say that everywhere else in the United States, even those of us who don't have very much money, we have more money than time. And in New Orleans, it is the exact opposite. They have more time than money. And so there is this sweetness to life because it is all about the moment. It's all about right now. And so people who taste that never want to give it up.
Although you have to leave, it seems, to become famous, whether you're Louis Armstrong or Mahalia Jackson or Dr. John.
Yeah, but the great thing about New Orleans is you go down there and those people, well, most of those are dead, but you know, you will see playing on a Saturday night in the Spotted Cat, a little bar on Frenchman Street, for free, people who up here you'll pay $60 to see. And they're just doing it because they love it.
There's very little discussion of politics in this book. George W. Bush is scarcely mentioned, and Michael D. Brown, Brownie, doesn't even come up once.
No, nope. It's not about the storm. This is not a Katrina book.
But you went down there thinking you were going to write about the storm.
No, I went down. I covered the storm for The New Yorker. And I was there for the event. I got there 2 days after the levees broke, and I was there for the event and for most of the first year after writing about the recovery. And I was getting increasingly frustrated because it turns out Hurricane Katrina is not the most interesting thing about New Orleans. The most interesting thing about New Orleans is this extraordinary kind of French-Spanish-based culture, much more like Mexico, where I used to live, than it is like the United States. This mysterious, fun-loving, colorful life that people live that is unlike anywhere else in the United States. And that's what I wanted to write about. And I couldn't write about all the people, so I picked nine and tried to make them as different as I could, tried to have them each represent a different side of the city. But they all, I think, share in this very New Orleans outlook on life.
You said that your initial accounts of the disaster were flawed.
Well, they were flawed because they were focused on the disaster and, you know, and on the mechanics of the recovery and this commission, that commission, the levees, the governor, the mayor. And at a certain point, I began feeling like that's not what is important here. What's important here is this place that's been here forever, that's going to be here forever. You know, my book begins in 1965, right after Hurricane Betsy floods a big part of the city. And it's not like all anybody has talked about in New Orleans since 1965 is Hurricane Betsy. It was terrible. People died.
Was it similar to Katrina?
It was. And, you know, people died. Houses were lost. The recovery was long and painful. But they got over it. And they're going to get over this one. And they largely are over this one. And so that's the book is about the city, not the disaster.
Well, let's talk about Betsy for a moment. The Bush White House was criticized strongly for its response to Katrina, specifically in the Ninth Ward. Had the response in 65 been better?
No, it hadn't. What was different in 65 is nobody expected it to be better. There was no expectation in 1965 that anybody would get any help at all. And in fact, one of my characters, one of the nine, who is a resident of the lower Ninth Ward, says, maybe that was better. He says this in the book. Maybe it was better in 1965. We knew we weren't going to get any help, so we all just came back and rebuilt. This time, the government dangled resources in front of us, and we all froze. thinking, oh, I got to wait until I get my share. And so it impeded the recovery. Now, that's his point of view. I'm not saying it's necessarily legitimate, but it is a point of view you'll hear in New Orleans.
Well, people who are not familiar with New Orleans point to its high crime and poverty rates as reasons that no one would want to live there.
Oh, yeah, but look.
Were you looking for people who felt love and loyalty to New Orleans, or look, did you find it everywhere you went?
Everywhere I go. Look, right before the storm, in May of 2005, Gallup did a survey in 20 cities. And they asked, it was an open-ended survey, just asking how satisfied are you with the quality of your life? More than 60% of New Orleanians reported themselves to be extremely satisfied with their lives.
Even though they may have been victims of crimes?
Oh, at a time when New Orleans was, by any metric, the worst city in the United States. The worst schools, the most corruption, the most violence, the most murders, the worst police force, the worst infrastructure. A dreadful city by the standards you and I would apply to what makes quality of life. But to them, that's not what it's about. They don't like those things. They don't like those aspects of their city. But that's not what life is about. Life is about the here, the now, the moment, seeing friends, seeing family, and making this minute sweet. And don't worry about tomorrow.
Is that why so many of the reviews of your book have described New Orleans as a misunderstood city?
I think it's very misunderstood. I think people either see it as kind of drunken and feckless and lazy, or they see it as an innocent victim. There was this kind of virgin and whore narrative going on after the storm that I found kind of offensive, that either New Orleans is this, oh, sweet, innocent victim, and, oh, the Bush administration beat it up and left it for dead, or and what happened kind of later, there was a backlash, and, oh, those people down there, we shouldn't send them any money, we shouldn't rebuild, they're so corrupt, they're so feckless and lazy. And neither is really true.
Well, they're stealing from the stores.
Oh, well, I stole from the stores. I stepped on my eyeglasses during the flood and went and looted a Rite Aid for some cheaters so I could see. I mean, you had to. If you wanted to eat or drink, you had to loot.
Were you surprised by the differences between the New Orleans that you imagined when you went down there and the one that you discovered after you'd been there for a while?
Yeah, I didn't know the city until...
Because I've been a tourist down there, and I thought it was colorful. I thought it was odd that... one of the fanciest streets, I think it was Royale, was just a block away from Bourbon Street, where it's hard to walk down the street without smelling people's throw up.
Even more amazing than that, because Bourbon Street is kind of an anomaly, but the richest people in New Orleans live a block or two away from the poorest people in New Orleans. Whereas here in New York, you can live on the Upper East Side, never go to Harlem, never go to the South Bronx, never really have to look at poverty. The richest people in New Orleans are right up against it all the time. It's an extraordinary, it's not like Beverly Hills being separated from Compton. Everybody lives cheek by jowl, and I think that makes the city, that adds to the extraordinary culture there.
My guest is Dan Baum, whose book, Nine Lives, Death and Life in New Orleans, is published by Spiegelau?
Spiegel and Grau.
We've been talking about the fact that you decided to look at nine different lives. How did you come up with the nine people that you
chose? Some of them I met. I mean, this transsexual bar owner on St. Claude Avenue I met during the flood, this Confederate gentry, very wealthy white Mardi Gras king I met during the crisis. I met this retired streetcar track repairman in the lower Ninth Ward soon after. But some I went looking for, like the band director. High school band is where jazz begins in New York, and I wanted a band director in my book.
You found a trumpet-playing coroner.
Oh, yeah. Well, he is the only public figure in my book, and he is a character. He is the parish coroner. He's a jazz musician, and it is through him that we see the emergency morgue after the flood. We also see through him earlier on kind of the transformation of the city over the years, from a segregated city and then through all of that. Again, it starts in 1965, so it's the storm doesn't show up until page 200.
Well, the only time I was in New Orleans, I got into a cab going from the center of town,
the French Quarter,
to some restaurant that was highly touted, and the driver got lost, and we went through a very poor area where we saw people sitting in front of these houses that all looked the same and looked very depressed, and the driver got very embarrassed because... I, as a tourist, was seeing something that people in New Orleans knew about, but that most other people were totally prevented from seeing,
you know,
protected
now,
from
now
seeing.
Now it's very different. Now they really want you to see it. They want you to see the destruction that the storm caused, although I must say I was just there, and you have to look for it now. The recovery has been remarkable in New Orleans, but people do want you to see that now.
Was there anything that linked the nine stories that you were investigating?
You know, certain of them do intersect physically. They run into each other. I never did find one narrative that would bring together, you know, this crackhead from the worst part of town and this Mardi Gras king, you know, from the best part of town, or all these people necessarily, although they do run into each other. Some of them run into each other. But they all share this New Orleanian thing. These people could not live anywhere else. These are not lives that you could mistake for lives in New York or Chicago or St. Louis or any place else.
Well, the recent Mardi Gras was much scaled down, which would suggest that the city is not coming back the way people expected it to.
I went to the first Mardi Gras after the storm, and it wasn't scaled down at all. They were roaring.
Well,
they were rocking.
I heard a news report that instead of three or four bands, it was one band.
Oh, well, but it was Mardi Gras. Nothing stops Mardi Gras. It was an amazing thing to see. I mean, the parades going through these ruined neighborhoods. It was really something.
Your book portrays New Orleans as a place where sexuality and race have different meanings than they do elsewhere in the United States. In what ways?
In New Orleans, I mean, I'm a Jewish guy from New Jersey, but I could tell people in New Orleans that I'm a black guy, and nobody's going to tell me I'm not, because skin color is not the determinant of race in New Orleans. Because, you know, the Spanish and the French, unlike the English, who banned sex between the races, the Spanish and the French deliberately created a mixed race buffer class between the slaves and the masters. So, in New Orleans, you have many people of various hues, and you really never know who you're talking to. And that may be why people are so polite down there, because you just don't know. When you're talking to somebody, does this person think of themselves as white or black? Now, things are as racially complicated in New Orleans as they are in the rest of the United States, but different.
We are talking about Louisiana, which is a state that was one of the deepest of the deep South states.
Right, but again, you know, originally settled by the Spanish and the French. So you have this mixed race culture that's sometimes called Creole that complicates matters immensely in a delightful way, I might add. And as for sexuality, New Orleans is just a tolerant place. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have this transsexual. Starts the book as John Guidos, ends the book as Joanne Guidos in there, because hers is a life that makes more sense in New Orleans than it might elsewhere.
How many of the people, the nine people, were white? How many were black?
I think I've got five black and one and four white.
Mm-hmm. And they range from very poor people to wealthy people.
Very
and people
poor.
Started
I mean,
off poor.
One guy I can't find, Anthony Wells. I can't even find him now because his life is so disorganized. He's in his 50s and he's always been a drug user, in and out of prison. And he is an economically useless guy. He has never had what you would call a job, but he's a delightful guy. And his language has a poetry and a sweetness and an incisiveness to it that is just marvelous. In fact, it's so great that I just step out of the way on him. And his chapters are just in the first person, just him talking. I can't find him. I went all over this dreadful neighborhood the last time I was there looking for him. And it goes all the way up to Billy Grace, who is this Mardi Gras king.
Well, many people had to leave, people you could not interview, because they never came back. Were they the people who didn't love New Orleans enough, or was it just impossible to survive in the city after Katrina?
You know, there were some who got outside of New Orleans and said, wow, look at this, streetlights that work, smooth pavement, schools with books, and stayed. A lot are desperate to come back. The suicides have been, you know, astronomical. There are a lot of people who didn't come back. But I started this book with two principles. One, I was going to have no bad guys. All my nine people are absolute heroes in my mind, and I write them that way. Even if they are not what we would call particularly useful or, you know, they are heroes, and all their stories end happily. And that was a bit of an artifice because I could have ended any one of them on a down note, but I wanted people finishing this book feeling good.
Recently, I spoke to someone who married a prisoner a man in prison in upstate New York, and she had visitation rights, and they put her in a trailer with him. And I said, oh, that's like New Orleans. She said, no. When I went down to New Orleans, I was shocked. The trailers in the prison were a lot nicer than the ones that they had in New Orleans.
Yeah, the whole trailer thing was a scandal. And the trailers, I'm happy to say, are largely gone.
But I did see a documentary film about how people are being cleared out of a perfectly fine housing development because it's in valuable land in the middle of town.
Well, that's a big issue down there. The public housing and the public hospital, which Huey Long built, the finest hospital for indigent people in the country, both of those have been closed since the storm. And it's an ongoing, very, very controversial, it's a huge battle going on there. And it's ugly because there is definitely this sense that, ooh, this is a chance to get these poor people out of this city and keep them out.
And who is responsible for that? The mayor is an African-American.
He is, in a manner of speaking. His skin is dark, but he is not well-beloved by the African-American population of New Orleans.
Do they like Bobby Jindal any better, the governor?
No, I don't like Bobby Jindal any better. You know, there are real estate interests and there are banking interests. And even the people of good heart who say the city will be better off without the public housing and without the two-tiered system, they're being fought because people really just want things to stay the same. People don't want a bigger and better city. They want the city back that they had before the storm.
Is that possible? Is that likely?
It's happening. It's happening. You know, the New Orleans has a lot of problems still, and people don't like the crime and the bad. Well, the schools have been fixed. I got to say, that's one thing that they really fixed since the storm. The schools are better. But, you know, people don't like the crime. They don't like the bad infrastructure. But they also don't want to live in a city that is run by the dollar and the clock the way that the rest of the United States is.
Have the tourists returned? Do
yes.
you still hear Mustang Sally as you walk down Bourbon Street coming out of every bar?
I stay off Bourbon Street, but you can have a great time down. You can go to New Orleans for a week or a long weekend and never know anything bad happened. You can have a great time. It's everything that a tourist would want to see is back and then some.
Dan Baum's book is called Nine Lives, Death and Life in New Orleans, and it's published by Spiegel & Grau. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.